Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic for the purposes of this particular podcast. You may call me Rockmeister McCool.
This is a very exciting episode of We've Got Mail because we're recording at Rockmeister McCool Central.
That's right. Located thousands of miles below the Earth's crust, my apartment.
The rent's not great. You'd think it would be better with that location, but no.
It's below San Francisco, and the rent is all the way down to the center. It's just high.
so we have to record this at Whitney's apartment. So this might, the audio quality might be a little different. Just wanted to give you a heads up just in case. But we're here to answer some emails from you, that's what we do with this podcast. Mm-hmm. How it works is real simple. You email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
It's P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. Send us a physical letter if you like. We received a package recently.
A mysterious package.
A generous gift of a board game from a fan of ours. Thank you very much.
And
it had a letter, and the letter was in code.
We have not cracked it yet.
We're not going to read that because we're not smart enough to figure it out yet.
I took a gander. Maybe I can figure this thing out. Maybe I can't. We're going to give it a try. But thank you so much for the puzzle. And thank you so much for the game, and we're gonna have to try that out soon. You rule. That's very, very kind of you.
One day when our podcast network takes over the airwaves or whatever they call YouTube these days, we can't say idiot box anymore, which upsets me.
No, the idiot rectangles.
The idiot rectangle. We'll have a video podcast of some kind where we can play tabletop games.
That'd be fun. We can
totally rip off tabletop of the Will Wheaton show.
They don't have playing games. Come on, that's like what all of Twitch is.
We don't
have the setup for that. Like we don't have good lighting or like
we're not,
a, or
we don't
have
a
clean table.
Yeah,
we don't have a clean table right now. So that's a ways off, but thank you so much, and we'll definitely give that a try and report back. So you email us, you ask us questions, you respond to our podcasts, you take us to task if we screw something up. The floor is yours. We try to get to as many as we can. We can never get to all of them, so let's just dive right in. Whitney, what's our first letter?
Here's a letter from OK.
Okay.
Yeah, just an initials OK. Dear Bibbs and Whitney, who apparently doesn't necessarily need a fun nickname. I don't necessarily need one. Thank you for reading and answering my first letter to your show.
Ooh.
You're welcome. It always gives me unreasonable amount of joy when I hear people I respect addressing me on their shows. I guess I crave the attention or something. But anyway, I decided to write again now that I noticed how easy it is, though I try not to do it so often that it gets weird and annoying. Though, didn't someone write you 100 times a year?
Yeah, that wasn't weird or annoying. It was actually kind of nice.
No, thank you, B. Peterson did that. And thank you, B, for writing in all of those letters. We couldn't read them all.
No, that would be the whole show if we did that. But we did get them all. We did read them all.
We read them on the show. Yeah. Anyway, as a hobby, I've been doing my own small film reviews on YouTube in Finnish for about a year now. Nothing as thoughtful or as deep as your professional criticism.
Pshaw.
We were just talking about Batman a minute ago.
It's fine. We did a solid 15 minutes on Batman's trunks.
The origin of the trunks and how that extends into the
and how we
of the
felt
male
about
physique.
The trunks. Yeah. That was a Patreon show. You're doing fine, I promise you.
It's just a casual I liked/didn't like this movie because reasons type of stuff. Yet despite my project being really small with only about 60 followers, it has been enough to get me access to local press screenings.
Hey,
and
nice.
Now even to upcoming content on Disney Plus.
Ooh, well done. Very cool. Good for you.
Now, an interesting problem came up with my review of the Beatles documentary series Get Back. The streaming service Disney presented it for critics and did not work well. The stream kept lagging, it kept making the experience really annoying. Normal Disney Plus runs so smoothly, it's not my shitty internet connection's fault either. In addition, no subtitle options were available. My English is quite good, and I usually only use English subtitles when watching English-speaking content, but no such things were provided for this critic's version of the show. It was really hard for me to understand the thick accents of the Beatles and to hear them when they mumbled. Now, neither of these problems are the fault of director Peter Jackson, nor the band members for speaking the way they speak, but it did affect my experience a lot, and probably made my review even more negative than it would have been had it been presented correctly.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I mean, imagine suffering almost 8 hours of that. Of course, I only do this for a hobby, so it doesn't really matter, so I can say almost whatever the fuck I want, can't I? But I'm curious, how would you as professionals deal with a situation like this? Do you think it's fair that poor presentation from the distributor affects your review in such a strong way? Personally, in my review, I explain the situation and put it on Disney for presenting it like that. Keep up being awesome, both of you, with love and respect. Okay.
I think you handled it well, okay. The way that we consume a work of art isn't necessarily the way that the artist wanted us to do so. Mm-hmm. You may look at a painting, but you're probably going to see a picture in a book. You're not going to see it live. You're not going to get the sense of the full texture. You won't get it in the perfect lighting wherever they painted it. Mm-hmm. That's not an option to you. You do what you can. You might have a favorite song, but you probably never heard it on perfectly mixed 7.1 speakers. You probably heard it on a radio or on a computer. Same thing with movies. Most movies are optimized to be seen on the big screen. Mm-hmm. Problem is, most movies are only available to be shown on the big screen for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months if they're really popular. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the time, they're on home video and you're either watching maybe like a pretty good Blu-ray, maybe a bad Blu-ray, it happens, or you're watching streaming and you're at the victim of, or not the victim, you're at the mercy, rather, of your streaming speeds. How many people are watching that day, how good the service is. And sometimes you get a situation like we sometimes get in screeners as critics where there's a lot of lag. There's a lot of loading times. Sometimes there's a lot of artifacting. Sometimes in order to prevent piracy, which really hasn't been a thing with critics
ever, really.
There's been like a couple of isolated incidents like 20 years ago. And since then, nothing. So they're kind of ruining the presentation of the movies for no reason. Sometimes they'll emblazon our name across the entire screen, and that's obviously very distracting. And so that's not ideal.
It's always nice when Nicole Kidman got my name tattooed on her face. I don't think it's... They say it's to prevent piracy, but I think studios do that to give their films a little bit more of a rarefied air. It's like a special product that you have to jump through a couple of hoops to get. Mm-hmm. It's not just something you can... They're trying to, like, add value to the experience.
Mm-hmm. They're maybe trying to discourage you from watching it that way. They want you to see it in a theater if you can, you know, with the best presentation that they can control.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it.
A lot of studios have been... That's a conspiracy theory mentality, though. In recent years, studios have been getting better about giving me better quality screeners.
That's true. It has gotten better.
There have been days when I had to wait 3 hours to watch a 90-minute film.
Yep.
Because I had to restart films numerous times.
Awful. Just awful.
If that's your only access to it, you just kind of have to gut it out as a critic.
Well, if you have to. If you're doing this as a hobby, you don't technically have to review anything. No. But if you're assigned it, or if it's like your job for like it's really important to you that you review this. Yeah, that's what you got.
Yeah,
you get the version you have. And if the problem with the presentation has nothing to do with the film itself, you shouldn't dock the film for it. It's not the film's fault, but you can talk about that. I mean, Ebert used to talk all the time about when he would like see a movie and the movie is fine, but the projection was... Oftentimes the projectionists would dim the light bulbs in the projector, or they'd unscrew it slightly. Ostensibly,
It's not like a light bulb you screw in at your...
Well, that's how he described it.
It's this gigantic contraption.
He described it that way. But in any case, the idea is if you dim the light bulb, you will extend the life of the light bulb and thus save money.
By the way,
that's not even true. So you're just ruining the presentation of the film for no fucking reason. Mm. So if a lot of filmmakers, when they have clout, like get really, you know, really severe about how they want their film to be shown. I know Paul Thomas Anderson is really gung-ho about trying to make sure people see his new film Licorice Pizza in 70mm on a screen. Christopher Nolan, obviously, is very, very big on making sure people get the full theatrical experience. Denis Villeneuve was very adamant that Dune be seen on the biggest screen possible. He couldn't control that, but that's what he wanted. And I'm sure it looks the best way possible there, but it also has to work other ways.
It has to work other ways, and... this became sort of a talking point with critics when 3D was big.
Mm.
And we would go to screenings and we would get it sort of like in the prime presentation. Yeah. You know, big screen with the 3D glasses, often like the best version of the 3D, because sometimes there are different levels of 3D, the quality of the glasses.
Well, there's glasses that like actually like flash, and there's glasses that are just lenticular lenses. And, and they work differently.
They work differently, and eventually they started giving options. Or do you want to see it in 2D or 3D? And a lot of critics would say, well, 3D. That's what the studio is selling. That's like the big experience. Uh-huh. That's the most extreme experience. And I typically chose 2D.
Same.
Just because I preferred it that way.
Well, and, 2D, there's a couple of things. One is most films, when you're watching them through 3D glasses, the 3D glasses absorb light.
So the movies like look darker. Shade, so it's still darker.
Yeah, so movies are darker. That doesn't necessarily help. And also, but, my theory is most people are going to see this on 2D eventually anyway.
Well, that was my thinking is, you know, even if the filmmaker comes out and says, I want this to be seen on the biggest screen possible, you as critics owe it to me to see this as in the biggest screen possible to get the experience I am intending. And there's integrity to that.
There's a lot of integrity to that. I can't find that.
But
it's also not practical always.
It's not practical, and if audiences are given a variety of options, we can review any one of those options, can't we? We are also audience members as well as being critics, so we can choose which version we want to see. If it's more convenient for me to watch Dune at home, I saw Dune at home.
Same.
My review is based on me seeing Dune at home.
Yeah.
Did that affect my my opinion of the movie? I think I got the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I wasn't overwhelmed by the sound and the visuals in quite the same way I would have been in a movie theater. But, you know, also if I go to see it in a movie theater, everybody's going to be in a different mood when they see it in a movie theater. If you see it at a different time of day, it's going to affect the way you see it.
There's a million different things that the filmmaker can't control.
Yeah, exactly. That your experience seeing the movie is going to be your experience.
Remember when we saw Dunkirk and there was like some kind of weird like framing problem or something?
Yeah, it was out of frame.
Yeah, it was like, it was in a theater, it was the perfect environment, it's exact. We even went to make sure we could see it in like 70mm, and they still fucked it up.
Yeah, because they trained people how to use a 70mm projector that morning.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to use one. They didn't have like a projectionist on staff at that movie theater.
Yeah, they had the same problem when I saw the critic screening of The Hateful Eight. And they were like, we have to come to this special theater and we'll show it in 70mm and it'll be the greatest thing ever. And then there was a problem with the presentation and it was out of focus in the middle. It was in focus on those edges, but not in the middle.
That's and that's a problem with the scope lens.
It is. I'm a projectionist, the lens is wrong.
So no, the lens was right.
The lens was. You clarify. Yeah. You clarify. You know better than that.
Well, it could have been a sign that the lens wasn't affixed all the way into the projector. That's a problem.
I think that's what it was. I think that's what I heard.
But when a scope lens, when you see a big sort of wide screen, the film isn't that shape. They use a lens to compress the image onto a 35mm film strip, and then they use the same lens that reverses that effect when they project it again. So it's stretched back out.
Have you ever seen an image on a scope, like 35mm, we actually see a film strip, you'll see everyone looks really stretched out.
Yeah, it's the image is distorted on the actual film strip, and the lens is the thing that corrects it. And because they're stretching an image using a single round lens, it's not going to be evenly in focus across. It's either going to be in focus in the center with slight focus on the outside, or it's going to be out of focus in the center and in focus on the edges. A good projectionist knows how to focus a scope lens, and clearly they didn't. It's either going to be soft all the way across, or you're going to find like a good balance as to where you want to lens. Let the focus land.
What is the expression that you've used before? It's like, I don't care what the filmmaker says in the end, the projectionist decides how the movie is presented.
The projectionist has final cut on every film.
That's what you said. I knew you had a more elegant way of doing it. Yeah.
It's like, yes, I worked really, really hard to get final cut. Really? Because, asshole, I have final cut on your movie.
I could just chop off some frames, like, motherfucker.
Oh, look, these two reels were run out of order. What a coincidence. What a weird thing. Look how I cut your movie. And, you know, it's not like I'm dramatically recutting it or remixing the sound or anything in the booth, but I'm choosing the volume level.
Yeah.
I'm choosing how
light
it's
level.
The light level. I'm choosing how it's presented. So ultimately, it's going to be up to the people who present it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of hilarious to me.
Mm-hmm.
That filmmakers put their feet down and, you know, or studios try to present it to critics in such a way that it's trying to maintain this sort of, like, purity of experience, when ultimately it's getting handed to teenagers who don't give a shit.
Well, I remember, like, there's a thing that's on a lot of high-definition TVs right now, and there's even a few that don't even allow you to fix this. It's called motion smoothing.
Oh, God.
Motion smoothing.
Who invented this abomination?
Is the devil.
Yeah.
To at least the cinema purists like ourselves. And basically, it affects the frame rate, and it also affects the clarity of movies. And the idea is that it's supposed to make everything, it makes everything look like you're looking through a window, like ultra real. But 99.99999999999% of the media that it ever has been or probably ever will be was not designed for that. Mm-hmm. Filmmakers wanted it to look a certain way with certain lighting and certain textures and certain frame rates. And so if you're watching something on a TV with motion smoothing, you're not watching it right at all. And I think, was it Ryan Johnson who used to talk about how, like, every time he goes into a hotel room, he tries to fix the motion smoothing on the TV
I've heard a lot of filmmakers say that.
Yeah. But the other thing you brought up in this email before we move on, I want to make it, because I think this is a slightly separate issue, but it's really important, is you wanted subtitles on your film.
Mm.
You should have subtitles on the film.
Yeah.
That's basic accessibility. That should be available in theaters as well. And some theaters do have it available. Most don't. But that is simply not accessible for people, A, with disabilities, mm-hmm. which is in and of itself a problem. But in a case like something like a movie where you're watching something in another dialect or another language, kind of a necessity.
Mm.
So the fact that that was not available stinks.
Here's a little insider baseball. When I saw the film Jungle Cruise.
Oh, there you go. Disney,
this is when I saw via a screener provided me by Disney. And they did provide subtitles for the main dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be like the Disney Plus experience. You have access on the screener as you would on Disney Plus. Curiously, there were no subtitles made available for the Spanish dialogue.
Yeah.
Now, it's not extensive Spanish dialogue. I could put it together.
Yeah, it's actually very little.
And in fact, I thought it was an artistic choice just to have the characters speaking Spanish, but it wasn't until after I saw the film that I was supposed to have seen, I learned that I was supposed to have seen
subtitles. Because under those circumstances, normally what would happen is there would be subtitles for those characters either way.
Yeah.
But I guess they just hadn't, it was an incomplete cut or something like that. But anyway, these are real problems. And as you become a critic and as you like do more critic things, you're going to run into the issues of the trade. A lot of this is real inside baseball shit.
Mm.
We've tried to sort of talk about how it affects everybody, but a lot of this is inside baseball shit. Every single job, even a cool job, sometimes it's a job. Mm. Sometimes there's crappy stuff that you just have to deal with. This is part of it. I'm very proud to say that LAFCA just put out like a thing where a press release basically
about accessibility.
About accessibility, saying that we're going to be more adamant that more screeners are available to people, to critics with disabilities from studios. This has never been fair, and it's only increasingly more obvious in the age of COVID and afterwards. So we're trying, but you know, it's not up to just one of us or one group. So we just need to keep talking about it and make sure that all these things are available, because there's no reason for them not to be.
Mm. All
right, let's move on.
Next letter is from Luke. Hello, Luke.
Hi, Luke.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I've been enjoying your content for several years now. You are my go-to critics for movie reviews and discussion.
Thank you.
It has all been great, except for now, I can't watch a movie without your voices in my head.
Oh, no.
I'm watching Ghostbusters Afterlife, and I can hear Whitney yawning at some parts. And when I watch Police Story, I hear Bibbs commenting on the awesome stunts.
Oh.
Come to find out, after I see a movie and then listen to your reviews, you duplicate what I predicted you would say.
Wow.
So this pretty much means we are brothers. I can't say I'm annoyed because your comments have led me to view films in a more meaningful way, but I often wonder what are my real opinions?
Oh, God.
Oh, no, we brainwashed you.
Oh, dear.
Do I think that it is a bad/good movie because of my own thoughts or because you have carved out a space for it in my brain? For discussion, have you had this experience with critics you looked up to in the past? Mm. Do you watch a film and know that a certain someone is going to love it or hate it? Thanks for the content. Sincerely, Luke, the giant wolf man.
Oh, God, that's
a throwback. Yeah.
That's a real big throwback. We were talking about the movie Rampage, and I was talking about how I always thought it was weird that there's a King Kong, gotcha, there's a Godzilla, gotcha. These all have precedent. These are all a reference to real things. But the third monster in the video game Rampage in the movie is a giant wolf man? When was there a giant wolf man? Who came up with this? I want to see that movie. I made a big to-do of it. But that's... First off, thank you. I worry we've ruined you in some way.
Well, what we've done is we've opened him up, haven't we? Mm-hmm. He is now sort of thinking about movies. I don't want to say the way we think about movies, but he's thinking about them on perhaps a little bit more deeply.
Oh, I hope so. It sounds like it.
As for yes, this has happened to me in the past.
Sure.
Where I was Roger Ebert is a big hero of mine.
Sure.
And back when he was still writing, I knew right away when I saw certain movies that Roger Ebert would like this kind of movie because he had his taste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you follow. This is kind of why we try to make sure we review everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we want that information to be available so that people will know the full context of our tastes.
Yeah.
So that information can be useful. If you listen to us enough, not that you have to, but if you do, you'll get a general sense of where we come from so that, at the very least, our opinions will make sense. Maybe not in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might be like, oh, why do they like that? But when you listen to all of our stuff, you'll be like, oh, I get it. I see where they come from. Yeah. I get why they like that stuff.
So you've been listening to us for a while. You get where we come from. That's fine.
That's fine.
That's fine.
But it can be a little distracting when you're constantly thinking about what other people might think of a movie instead of just watching it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a problem. And I've had that sometimes when I've been in like relationships with people with really strong opinions.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I know that the person I'm on a date with right now is hating this, even though I'm loving it.
Yeah.
And that can be...
I don't want to have that discussion after the movie.
No, I'm not looking forward to this at all. Or vice versa.
Mm.
And that can be frustrating. And it's not really fair to you to have to, like, compete with these inner voices to, like, just appreciate the film. I encourage you to tune us out. I do. At least when you're in a theater, I encourage you just watch it for yourself and don't worry about what anyone else thinks. I can fall into this trap. I care about other people. There are people who I really care about what they think. But it's, I mean, and granted, this is me talking about someone to whom this is my job. It's my job to have my own opinions right here. That doesn't mean I'm going to disagree with anyone necessarily, but it means that if I do agree or if I do disagree, I want it to be genuine and not because I'm chasing someone's approval. Or I have so much respect for someone that I assume they're right about everything. Or even the opposite. If I find like, oh, that person likes it, it probably stinks. Maybe it's great. I don't know. You have to give everything a fair shake. So we're really, really honored that you've listened to the show for so long that you've got that. But I hope at least after a while you're able to sort of just watch it for yourself again and not worry about what we're thinking at all. To really not trouble yourself with it. I think that goes in waves, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there are times when, like, you're like, because of what's going on in your life, even when you watch a movie, things that can tend to go through that lens. Like, I remember when my father died, that kind of affected the perspective I had on any movie I saw for a while. Especially because I'm going through a major life event, you know?
And a lot of movies are about fatherhood, so.
Fatherhood, yeah, or even just death. Or end of life care, or just, you know, whatever. All the incidents or anything reminding me of my dad, that's the filter I have right then. And that's natural, and I shouldn't shy away from that, but I should also acknowledge that that's not necessarily a permanent state of being.
Mm-hmm.
That's just where I'm at right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's going to happen too. So just hopefully it's a phase, and it'll just sort of move along, and you'll have other voices in your head, and hopefully your own will be the loudest. Yeah,
if we can guide you a little bit, great. Other people can guide you as well, and you can guide others, as it turns out.
Yeah, that's really exciting.
Just have conversations with others. It's about having other perspectives, and we're here to offer ours.
Mm-hmm.
That you're listening to ours is very flattering.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. I mean it.
Sometimes I'm embarrassed when I find out that like somebody I know listens to the podcast. It's like, oh, shit,
not you. this is for strangers.
This is going out into like an ether.
Yeah, or, no one's like, listening.
The listeners are abstract on a certain level. Yeah. It's like, no, I've been listening to your show for a while. Oh, shit.
I was at the...
You're going to hear what I said about Clifford the Big Red Dog.
I was at the Schmodown Spectacular this last weekend, and I ran into quite a few people who said that they listened to the show. Some of whom are people who I know personally, and I was like, you actually take the time to listen to the show? You just talk to me? Okay, well, fine. But I'm super honored, and if anyone who I was having that conversation with is listening right now, hi!
Hello!
Thank you so much. It means a lot to us, but sometimes it's a little weird.
Close personal friends of mine, or co-workers
of mine. We're doing this in our apartment... Like, yeah, yeah. this is something that, like, it's an act of love, and we're doing it, and we're trying to make it work, we're trying to be successful at it, but it is super weird that anyone else listens to it sometimes. So thank you so much, and thank you for writing in, and that's a really, really great question, and let's move on.
Here's a letter from Tim L.
Okay.
Hello, Tim L. Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I hope your day or very late night is going so far.
I assure you it's a very late night.
It's a late night tonight.
What time is it right now?
I'm not going to say. You know what? They don't need to see that detail behind the curtain.
It's after midnight, isn't it?
It's after midnight. Okay. I've been listening to you two for a few years now, and I really enjoy your podcasts. I think you're both insightful, and I value your opinions.
That means a lot to us. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the What's Up Duck recommendation.
Oh, yeah. That was great.
My question. What is schlock exactly? I've heard you guys use that word fairly often, especially when talking about horror movies. Schlock, to me, is one of those things that I feel like I could identify if I saw it, but I couldn't really explain it if I tried. Google describes it as, quote, cheap or inferior goods or materials, semicolon, trash. I was hoping you two would also be able to give some additional context. How would you describe schlock? Is it an inherently telltale sign of low quality or subpar film? How might schlock look between various film genres? Thank you for the help, Tim L.
That's a great question. I love this question. Thank you for that question.
Schlock is a Yiddish word, and yes, it means like inferior goods.
Yeah. However, that's
the etymology. Well, it's not necessarily the way we use
it. It's not necessarily the value of the good, though. It's more of the way it's produced.
The way we use it, that is.
The way
we use schlock is, let's see if I can put this succinctly. It is falling back on the easiest and most obvious tropes within certain genres.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds pretty broad, but which I mean to say is, let's take like the three mainstays of schlock genre. That is horror, action, and science fiction.
Okay.
When I describe any of those types of movies as schlock, there tends to be a lack of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
There tends to be a certain element of cheapness, although not necessarily, because sometimes it can just come from a certain kind of well-worn, cliched story trope.
Yeah, it can be more of a mentality than an actual monetary
that
value.
That comes from an exploitation, drive-in, grindhouse tradition.
Yeah.
So a movie can be... Let's look at the movie Red Notice.
Okay, yeah, that's
a movie everybody looked at and then forgot about, and then looked at again and then forgot about.
Absurdly expensive motion picture.
Absurdly expensive, absurdly popular. More people have watched...
Popular is not the same as... Just because you watched it doesn't mean you liked it.
Something doesn't have to be liked to be popular. People have been crunching numbers on Red Notice, and all we've gotten from Netflix is like the number of minutes people have watched it.
Mm-hmm.
But even if people only watched it for 10 minutes, if you sort of distribute that among sort of the general population of Netflix users, more people were exposed to Red Notice than were exposed to Avengers Endgame. Like, it's reached a greater number of people just by raw data.
And I think that's a matter of ease of accessibility and you can
put your thumb on the scale all you want. More people laid eyes on it.
I'm putting my thumb on the scale. I'm explaining how a scale works. I think it's a different thing.
Yeah, but just anyway. more, it hit more eyeballs than hit eyeballs of Avengers Endgame.
Okay. I'll let it go.
Red Notice, it's an absurdly expensive film. They hired this all-star cast. They shot in all these exotic locations. It's got expensive special effects. It is an A-budget studio feature film. Mm-hmm. It's also schlock.
Yeah.
Because it falls back on a lot of well-worn character types and story beats and genre trappings that were introduced or at least popularized or at least easy to produce in a really low-budget venue.
I would say that what you're talking about here is, I think the word I would use is hackneyed, which is like, this has been done before. This has been over and over and over again. Nothing about this is unfamiliar. Maybe it's done in a slightly different way or with a slightly different lens on it. But this is all stuff that you're familiar with. This is all stuff that has been done a million times before. And it also tends to be done with a lack of ambition.
Mm.
Like, you can make an action movie that's about stuff. A lot of people have.
Yeah.
You can also make an action movie that's about nothing. At all, like Red Notice, where it's just about sexy people winking at each other and then jumping on things and then getting in a car chase and then giggling. And that's kind of the whole goddamn film. Like, there's nothing... It's very... It's often very juvenile. Mm-hmm. But here's the... I wish we could come up with a more concise terminology. Because Google's definition or whatever dictionary Google led you to was pretty general. And I firmly believe that when it comes to genre, quality cannot be a definition in a genre. Because it can be done good or bad, but it's still a horror movie, that kind of thing. It can be if it doesn't matter if your jokes are funny. If you're telling jokes, you're a comedy, that kind of thing. Mm. But schlock, I think, is a qualitative statement. I think schlock is not a genre. Schlock is a tone, and it's a tone that it's easy to do with no money, and it's easy to do with a lot of money. All you have to do is not try very hard, but also hopefully have fun, and you can totally have fun schlock.
A lot of filmmakers try for schlock and I think fail, where they're trying to have like a little bit of trashy fun and it ends up being a little bit too slick for its own good. I feel this way about the films of James Gunn. I feel like back when he was writing for Troma, he's making good schlock.
Yeah.
Because that is like trashy and confrontational. Watch Troma and Juliet. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
But it's daring. Yeah. You know, it's actually like, I would hesitate to call it ambitious, but it's go for broke.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically like, we're going to throw everything out here and just see if we can get a reaction out of you.
Meanwhile, he made a film just this year called The Suicide Squad, which contained a lot of schlocky elements. There's giant monsters and violent death and
like there are rats that are killing a giant star creature. Yeah, and that's like, okay, that's schlock. But once you add the context of, yes, but the rats represent the underdogs and all of us who are truly the heroes here. And I'm like, stop being schlock.
You're taking away from the trash of this. Yeah. I'll say this. When we go to movies, you know, you and I are critics. We like to find the art in film. And we explore the medium as it is a moving, living, breathing, artistic form. There's also something incredibly basic about films when we go to see them. We want to see sex and violence. Often. We want to see explosions.
We want to see car chases.
Yeah, I've heard some people say, and I typically get pretty frustrated. It's like, oh, I liked the new Godzilla film okay because Godzilla was in it, and that's my only standard. It's like, well, shouldn't you have higher standards?
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're here just to be entertained and have sort of our basest impulses catered to. That's what exploitation means, and I feel like there is a certain deal of fun that can be had when your basest instincts are being catered to.
Maybe schlock would just be, it would just be easier to say exploitation cinema. I feel like there's that people have got a bit more of a lock on that. There's a lot of overlap.
Exploitation is a little bit more descriptive of a certain budget class or even genre of film.
But I think Bruce also saying that about schlock as well. I mean, you said yourself that when we think of schlock, we typically think of genres like horror. But there's also schlock in every single genre, and I would say this, like, even something like, because we're talking about what are the base things that we come to see in a movie, you know, like sex and violence. But let's switch it around. Let's go to a different genre. We've also seen schlocky romantic comedies. People go to romantic comedy for very base reasons as well. We want comfort. Yeah. We want love and romance has always been fucking complicated. Doesn't matter what generation you live in. There's always some bullshit getting in the way, whether it's human nature or circumstance or social mores, whatever it fucking is. It's always more complicated than it needs to be. A romantic comedy is where you watch a movie and two hot people eventually are going to get together. There'll be some problems at the beginning. They'll be fine in the middle. There'll be some problems towards the end. And at the end, it usually turns out more or less fine.
We're reminded of the Patton Oswalt bit.
Yeah.
Every romantic comedy should be called Trying to Fuck.
And that's kind of what it is. That's basically the deal. But like when we go to a romantic comedy, we want these baseline... We want these particular endorphins, please. It's not the car chase endorphins. It's the happy ending endorphins. Then you can be schlocky about that, too. And there's so many romantic comedies that are just ripping off It Happened One Night over and over again or whatever. Like, and, like, you can have a schlocky rom-com without any of that sex or violence.
I suppose so. I think, in my mind... And
like
this,
that's what Hallmark movies are. They're schlocky rom-coms.
Yeah. Schlock typically has sort of a dismissive quality to it. It's meant as... used as a criticism, although sometimes we use it very positively.
I use it very neutrally. I think it's an attitude, and I think it can be done well or badly.
The word typically it has a weight on it.
It does, but I also think that as critics, we have the power sometimes to...
reweigh a word,
Because I was referring to a TV show I was reviewing as soap operatic. because there's a lot of relationship melodrama and serialization.
Which sounds merely descriptive.
For me, it's really merely descriptive, but I was talking to another critic who was reviewing it with me on like this show, and they were like, whoa, 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 let's not say things we can't take back, because to them, that's a derogatory statement. Soap opera, or rather the daytime television shows like As the World Turns, General Hospital, One Life to Live, whatever. No, One Life to Live is something different, but like, whatever, Passions. These shows were often derided by the mainstream. I grew up watching these shows. I know they can be good and they can be bad, but I also know they're just another form of storytelling. What makes a soap opera is not whether or not it's bad. What makes a soap opera is whether or not it's an ensemble melodrama told in a serialized fashion. That's a soap opera.
Yeah.
It's not derogatory. It just is what it is. Schlock is just a general attitude of we're going for the low-hanging fruit of whatever genre we're doing right now.
Yeah,
and we don't need to spend any money on it. We can just have a good attitude about this and give people what they want and not try to blow their minds or make them think about anything. And you can do that with any different genre. Mm. And you can do that really, really well. And you can do that really, really badly.
And there's most certainly a lot of respect and integrity to making just devoting yourself to something schlocky.
Yeah.
And as somebody who has seen a lot of bad exploitation movies and enjoys them quite a bit, I actually have a good deal of affection for schlock. I don't personally use it in terms of romances. If I'm going to refer to schlock, like I would call Temptation Confessions of a Marriage Counselor schlock.
True.
Because that's... I use schlock typically to describe sex and violence.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk about like... a family film or a romance, that's I refer to like treacly or sentimentality, which is in my mind, and this is just the way I wield the word, different from schlock.
Fair enough. And I think maybe what we're dealing with here is the idea that the way we use schlock, and maybe not everyone uses it this way, I'm sure not everyone does, maybe we do need to come up with a better, like a proper definition for this, because I feel like I think we've been rambling, and I hopefully people will understand where we're coming from here, but this is not a dictionary definition.
No. Well, we could give you the dictionary definition. Yeah. You can look it up.
Yeah, but the dictionary definition isn't necessarily always up to date, because the way we use words evolve.
The way we use it as critics, as they pertain to film, then, we're going to have to have a little bit more fineries and nuances.
Did I mention that I'm in the dictionary?
Are you in the dictionary? I'm on Wikipedia.
I'm on Wikipedia, too. Oh, I don't have a page on Wikipedia, but I have I'm quoted on sometimes on some movies. But no, I was having an argument on Twitter with somebody, and they were like, we were talking about what the definition of hero was, and I was like, well, I can look up the definition of hero and tell you about that. So I looked it up. I think it's on Merriam-Webster or one of those. And one of the examples, like they give an example of like, here's a bit of writing, was something I wrote.
Oh, wow.
And they were using like an article I had written about... female action heroes in movies as evidence that the word hero is now gender neutral. Yeah. It used to be considered not gender neutral. A hero and heroine were separate. But in order to provide evidence that this is in popular usage and it's perfectly acceptable to use the word hero as a gender neutral term, they use my writing.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. That was me. I had no idea. What are the odds that it would just happen to run into that? Super weird.
It is kind of unfortunate that the masculine is also the gender neutral.
Yeah.
Whereas the feminine... Well,
sometimes the masculine is... I don't know if this is the case, but sometimes what we consider the masculine isn't even that masculine. Actor, I don't think, is a masculine term. I think we just added the feminine suffix to that, didn't we?
The actor, actress. I think... I'd have to look up the etymology.
I'm going to look up the etymology of actor, because I'm pretty sure that one's...
But I know nobody uses the term directrix.
Yeah.
To describe somebody who directs a film, director is it's the masculine form, but we use that as a pretty gender.
I'm just gonna look up the suffix tor,
T-O-R T-O-R. I think that's I think it's Greek, but I don't know. I'm not a language is an interest of mine, but I'm no expert.
There's nothing masculine about it. It's just a suffix found in loan words from Latin. Forming a personal agent, like someone who does this. Okay. An actor is someone who acts. A director is someone who directs. Mm. But it's not inherently gendered. Yeah. For so long, it was considered a masculine occupation that in order to differentiate between a proper hero and a, they decided to add, or a hero might be different, but like actor.
Mm.
In order to differentiate from a male actor, we needed an actress. And this might even stem. I'm wildly speculating here, but there used to be women used to not be allowed to act in like Oh, well, it plays in England, you know, that kind of thing.
In England at a certain time.
Well, we're talking about the English language, so. Yeah, that's true. Anyway. Anyway, we're way off base here. We're going off into pure speculation territory. We're not talking about stuff we know offhand. We're just trying to define schlock. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we've done that a little bit. Hopefully we've cleared it up, at least how we refer to it, even though maybe we shouldn't be adding this to the dictionary yet. let's move on.
All right. Here is a letter from Name Redacted. If you don't send off your letter, you have no name. Mm-hmm. This is, Name Redacted. Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. Australian fan writing in.
Hi.
I was listening to your most recent Iron List and was thrilled to hear Whitney put the Aussie classic Walkabout on his top 10 films of 1971. And you haven't seen Walkabout yet.
No, Walkabout's one I missed, yeah.
It's very, very good. Please watch Walkabout.
Yeah, we both put Wake and Fright in there as well.
Two Australian movies. I wasn't sure when you guys taped the episode, but it came upon my ears only a couple of days after the tragic passing of David Atalatingu. Also known throughout his life as David Gulpilil,
yeah,
who was the main character in Walkabout, one of the three main characters. His family requested for him to be referred to as Dalatingu, in accordance with his native custom. David lost his battle with lung cancer on the 29th of November at the age of 68.
Yeah. I think we recorded around that time. I don't think we knew yet.
I think he had passed, but we just didn't get the news yet. Yeah. David was a titan of Australian cinema, with iconic roles throughout the decades, including Storm Boy, Rabbit Proof Fence, The Tracker, Ten Canoes, Charlie's Country, and of course Walkabout. I just wanted to thank you for including Walkabout. I'm not sure if it was a coincidence or not, but it was assuring to see David's legacy felt beyond his native land, of which he has left an indelible mark. Signed, Name Redacted.
Thank you so much. And he's an actor who I think we wanted to eulogize, but didn't necessarily feel qualified to, because his career is often in things that we're less familiar with. I'd seen him in Crocodile Dundee as a kid, but you know, he didn't have a very big role in that movie. You know.
Yeah, he's
good in it, but like he only has like two scenes. So you know.
He's funny in those two scenes.
He's great in those two scenes.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but it's quite a funny film.
It's a good film. It's the fish out of water stuff. There's at least one scene in it that is pretty aggressively homophobic by any standard.
But
other than that, it's pretty good. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a big if. That's a big asterisk, I think.
I like the scene where he throws the knife in the guy's mohawk.
Yeah. I like the scene. There's this weird scene at the end where it's like, the stakes are so artificially raised at the end of that movie, because he's just going to go on a subway and leave. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to tell him like, no, I don't love this other guy. I love you. And he's like, great. Cool. But it's really crowded on this subway. Mm-hmm. And instead of just waiting for everyone to leave, he decides to like, jump up and grab like a beam and like walk on everyone's head to talk to see her.
Oh, it's dramatic.
It's super dramatic, but there's no reason. It's not like he'll never see her again unless he does that. It's just, it's fun because it's fun, not because anything demands it. That's one of the reasons why that movie was nominated for Best Original Screenplay, is because they found the big moments to tell the story, you know?
That scene, and of course we're going to talk about Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
He was used to living out in the outback.
Yeah.
And he was by himself a lot. And he ended up moving to New York, which is full of people. It's really crowded. Mm. And that showed how the community of New York was actually able to bring people together in a way that he didn't experience before. Yeah. During that scene, like, Linda Kozlowski is shouting out messages to Crocodile Dundee, played by Paul Hogan, she has to sort of relay it. There's like this game of telephone across a crowd. And there's like a couple New Yorkers who are shouting out, like, I love you, over to Crocodile Dundee. So, of course, he finally hears that. And he says, okay, I'm going to come back so we can actually, like, talk face to face. So it was also organic to the scene. It wasn't as artificial as you're making it out.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, it's a pretty good movie with like one flaw. But anyway, yes, thank you so much for writing in. And thank you so much for giving us an opportunity to talk about David Gulpilil, and a great actor and deserved their due, and I'm glad someone was able to on our show.
Next letter.
Yeah.
Here's a letter from Cody.
Hi, Cody.
Hi, Cody. Hello, William and Whitney. I hope both of you are doing great. As I tip this email, Major League Baseball is in lockout for the first time since 1994.
I don't know what that means.
It means nobody's playing.
Oh.
So to help fill in the baseball void in my life, what do you think are some of the best and some of the worst baseball movies?
Ah.
Both suggestions are welcome. Thank you for all that you do, and have a happy holiday season. Sincerely, Cody.
Yeah,
baseball movies.
I'm on record. I've said this before. I'll say it again. Not a huge fan of sports in real life, but I love sports movies. Sports movies are great.
The drama is baked into the game, isn't it?
Yeah, so like everything has to come to a big head through competition, and that's inherently dramatic. There are really, really great baseball movies out there. I recently saw for the very first time the original Angels in the Outfield.
Oh, okay.
From 1951. And I thought it was charming as hell. And it's about, because the remake is what most people know about. It's about a kid who wants to see his dad, and the dad says, yeah, I'll come be your dad again when the Angels win the pennant. So, like, he makes a Christmas wish or something, and the Angels decide to, like, help him win the pennant or whatever. The original, it's all about how the coach of the Pittsburgh Pirates is just a real piece of shit. Like, he's not evil, he's just an asshole. And so, basically, a little kid who just loves baseball, like, prays for, like, him to get better and for the team to get better. And he finds out the kid made this wish, and that's why, you know, his team is whatever. It's charming. It's super cute. I like that one a lot. For me, the gold standard in baseball movies is A League of Their Own.
Okay.
League of Their Own is, to my understanding, the history is pretty good. Not entirely accurate, but pretty good. Wonderful cast of characters. Every single person in the ensemble, whether they have a big role or a small role, gets a really, really good character bit, and they have a lot to play. It's very witty. It boils down to, you know, some really good baseball gameplay, and the climax isn't so much about who will win as about the relationship between two competing players, and I care more about that than who wins, and I think that's really, really good. That they haven't, like, artificially inflated it to just be about who's going to win the Sugar Bowl or whatever the fuck it is. Like, I just, that movie is just, that's one of my favorite films, just period, A League of Their Own. So that's definitely up there. I'm trying to think. What are some of yours?
I'm not sure I have many. Okay. Baseball is a very strange sport. One of the only funny scenes in an otherwise utterly repellent movie, The Ridiculous Six, involves the main character running into Abner Doubleday, the inventor of baseball, and the joke of the scene, Abner Doubleday is played by John Turturro, and the joke in that scene is, I forgot the actual context, but he's making up a game just to sort of occupy, I think there's some, like, workers, and he is clearly, like, the joke is that he's just making it up as he goes. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so I hit the ball. Now what happens? Run to that tree. Okay, what happens to that? Okay, now run over to that tree. Okay, and so now I'm at this tree. What happens? You know what? Hit that tree and then go back to where you started, and that's a point. like, he's clearly just making this up.
Because the rules in baseball are kind of weird if you think about it. Mm, yeah.
It's one of, like, the least logical games, and as such, it doesn't have the same sort of crest and drama, I feel, as a lot of other sports that get sports movies made.
I feel like baseball almost feels like, almost plays a bit like a board game, where it's like, okay, you go around to this part of the board, and is someone there? Well, they get pushed over there. And, but there's a way for your opponent to, like, knock them out in the middle if they, like, land on, like, the I touch it with the ball spot or whatever like that.
My dad took me to a couple baseball games when I was a kid. He also took me to basketball games. Basketball is an exciting sport because there's always movement.
People are
running and passing the ball, and they're sort of in this confined space, and it's actually really exciting. Baseball, you're just sort of waiting for somebody to hit a ball that you can't really see. At least not with the seats we had.
Yeah.
So it was a little less exciting. So when it comes to baseball movies, I feel that they play to me as more artificial than even most sports movies, which are plenty artificial to begin with.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of baseball classics I haven't seen. I haven't seen 8 Men Out. I haven't seen either of the Angels in the Outfield.
8 Men Out is great. 8 Men Out isn't really... 8 Men Out's about baseball, but it's not about the competition.
Okay.
Because it's about a group of real-life baseball players who conspired to, I can't remember the details, shave points or whatever like that, but basically they besmirched the game.
Okay.
And it was all about the fallout from that and them trying to defend themselves in front of, like, council or whatever. Movie's great. Amen Out is the shit.
I only recently saw Field of Dreams for the first time.
Really? Only for the first time?
And that's a big ball of corn in it.
Yeah, it's a good ball of corn, though. Like, it's It's the handle with such sincerity, that film. I love that film.
I saw The Natural as a kid. I only remember the lightning bolt scene. I don't remember any of the baseball at all.
I'm not a huge fan of The Natural. I haven't seen it in a long time, though.
A lot of people consider The Sandlot to be a modern classic. I haven't seen The Sandlot.
I grew up with The Sandlot, and revisiting it more recently, I realized that, boy, is there a lot of toxic masculinity in that fucking thing.
Yeah, which part of the joke. But
it's part of the joke, but it's also, some of it's not, and I'm not a huge fan of some of its attitudes, even though I think a lot of it holds up good. The original 1976, The Bad News Bears,
I've seen that one.
Good. Like, it's a really sharply done, great character work throughout.
A lot of crass racist language in that.
Also true, but there's a lot of good stuff in there too. A lot of people love the movie Moneyball. I'm amazed that that movie has the legs that it has. I find it really emotionally distant. The entire film. I realize it's about sort of de-romanticizing the game.
The point is about sucking the romance out of baseball.
And you can do that, but do you have to suck the romance out of the movie? I don't think you needed to do that. I think that's a mistake. There's a really good made-for-TV movie on HBO called Long Gone, starring William Peterson, Virginia Madsen, and Dermot Mulroney. That's about like a minor league team and a bunch of like old washed up guys who are doing it because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Like they're never going to go to the big leagues, but hardly anyone goes to see their games, but that's the only thing they know how to do, and they got to do something. And there's something kind of noble about that, I think. So I like that one a lot. Nobody talks about it, but it's quite good.
Let's see. Bad baseball movies. I've seen a couple of those. The trouble with the curve with Clint Eastwood is
schmaltz.
It's like drinking it, just maple syrup straight out of the bottle. I didn't see the movie Ed, but it's,
I always wanted to.
It's about a baseball playing chimpanzee
who teams up with Matt LeBlanc.
Maybe it's good. I don't want to dismiss it out of hand.
Yeah.
I saw 42. I thought 42 is the Jackie Robinson
film.
That's pretty good. I thought that one was pretty good.
Yeah.
The one I watched multiple times as a kid was Major League.
Yeah.
And I liked that because the characters were funny, not because it was baseball.
Yeah. Yeah. Major League. And I even have a soft spot for Major League 2. I think it's some funny stuff in Major League 2. I just had another good one. And there are others as well, I guess.
Didn't Tommy Lee Jones play Ty Cobb in a movie?
He did. It's a movie called Cobb. I feel like I saw that when it came out, but I don't remember it very well.
Right.
What else?
I've heard The Babe was quite bad.
The Babe is not great. That's not a particularly good one. There's a decent, not amazing, but there is a decent Little League movie called The Perfect Game, starring Clifton Collins. Clifton Collins Jr., sorry, as a former baseball pitcher who decides to coach a Mexican Little League team, and it all culminates with that team pitching a perfect game, which is rare in any context, let alone Little League.
I strike out every batter.
Yeah, it really suffers from some budgetary woes every now and then. Like, there's like some not good green screen in it. But Clifton Collins really grounds that thing, and he makes it work. I kind of find that movie rather good, and I wish more people had seen it.
Did you see the Sam Raimi baseball movie?
Oh, From Love of the Game?
Love of the Game.
It's good. It's not great.
All right.
A lot of some of the bigger ones are ones that I haven't revisited Bull Durham since the 80s. So maybe it is amazing, but I haven't seen it in a long time. So that one I can't really speak to.
Haven't seen Bull Durham either.
There you go. I'm trying to think here.
I never saw the remake of Bad News Bears to baseball movies.
Yeah,
I did see the
bench warmers. Is not good. Oh, Hardball is awful.
the one with Keanu Reeves.
Oh my god, that is the melodrama on that movie is like caked on like butter.
Well, we did a commentary track for The Replacements, which is the Keanu Reeves football movie.
Yeah, but that one's fun. Hardball is like trying to be like really hard hitting and make you cry, and I think it really oversells it. Oh, the one I'm thinking of that's actually like it's good until it's bad is The Scout, starring Albert Brooks and Brendan Fraser.
Okay.
Brendan Fraser plays a talent scout who finds a pitching wunderkind played by a relatively young Brendan Fraser. He's living in the middle of nowhere, and so he brings him to America to play. And he's very, very excited. The guy pitches like the fastest fastball in history. But Albert Brooks increasingly becomes aware that he has extreme mental health problems. And he has to, he gets him into therapy with Diane Wiest, and Diane Wiest is saying for this person's mental health, he should not play baseball.
So it's the Bobby Fischer story. Searching for
Bobby Fischer elements to it. It's not, Bobby Fischer isn't quite about that, but the problem is that they tacked on this, like, really hokey, stupid Hollywood ending. That's like has nothing to do with the movie that came before it. It's actually a pretty good movie about mental health and the way that like people are willing to overlook mental health issues if it benefits them. And then it just has a hokey Hollywood ending that has nothing to do with anything that came before it. And it's a real pain in the ass because before that I quite liked it a lot. Albert Brooks was notoriously unhappy with that too. So but until then it's good. So like skip the last act. It's a pretty good film.
I did see a movie about a talent scout called Million Dollar Arm.
Oh, yeah, with where, John Hamm. Yeah.
Well, John Hamm, but really Fred McMurray.
It is
a Disney film, and it feels like a Disney film from the 60s. Like, it has that kind of square thinking.
John Hamm plays a baseball talent scout.
A little bit like Fred McMurray.
He plays a baseball talent scout who goes to India to try to find like fresh talent from cricket players.
Cricketers who are good to turn them into baseball pitchers.
And so he brings them to America, and there's some fish out of water stuff.
The players like have to live with him in his house, and he's all business. And I think he's a single man. His tenant is played by Lake Bell.
Yeah.
And so they sort of try to make the players try to get the romance started between he and Lake Bell.
Yeah, it's full of cliches. That's one where like you could call that schlock.
See, this is maybe this is why I think baseball films are corny. The ones I've seen are really corny.
Well, that is a really corny film. But I will say this: I have a lot of affection for Million Dollar Arm for one particular reason. When I saw that movie, I was this close to quitting being a film critic.
Oh, yeah.
I was just because there was so much like behind the scenes like bullshit and the way publishing works.
And it just wasn't
fun anymore.
We actually were lamenting the passing of the late great James Rocky recently and how he left the business because he was kind of disgusted with how closely tied film journalism is to just mere advertising now.
Yeah, and then I watched Million Dollar Arm. This is incredibly hokey, ultra Disney-fied, made by Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Movie about why baseball is nifty. And at the end of the movie, John Hamm remembers that, if you're going to do something, you should do it for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And he remembers that he does what he does, not to make money, not whatever, but because he likes baseball.
Mm.
That's the reason to do it. And at the end of the movie, I was thinking to myself, I do this because I like all this bureaucratic bullshit, all this red tape, all of this office work, whatever, that's getting me down. That's just the bullshit I don't like.
Hmm.
The actual thing I like is still here. And if I'm going to keep doing this, I just need to remember that. And that's why I'm still here today. Million Dollar Arm is the reason why I'm still a film critic right now.
Okay.
So I can't hate that movie much. And it's also something I try to remember sometimes when someone tells me they love a movie that I think very little of.
Hmm.
It's because it might be just the movie they needed that day.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to retell a story that's been told a million times, but it's got an inspirational message, as long as it's told reasonably well, I'm fine with you. Because you might be exactly what someone needed that day. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be mad at Million Dollar Arm, even though it's pretty cheesy. So, anyway. What are we at on time? I can't hear the recording.
We've been going for about an hour here.
Okay, well I think it's do we have one more? Or do you want to like wrap it up?
Let's see if I can find a brief one.
Okay, super quick.
Yeah.
Yes or no questions.
Okay, that's a long letter. I don't usually object to long letters. Here we go. This one actually starts with quick questions.
So okay.
Here we go. Hey, Whitney and Bibbs, quick question. What is Mumblecore? Or Mumble Gore, for that matter. I'm sure I can just Google it, but prefer to ask you guys, because I like the way you explain things. Thanks, film professors. Sent from my iPhone. Well sent from my iPhone. Mumble Gore is a certain flavor of independent cinema that kind of rose to prominence in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
That dealt with a lot of typically young people,
mm-hmm.
Talking a lot.
Yeah.
And a lot of the, it was incredibly low budget.
Yep.
A lot of the lighting was bad. I think that's like
a lot of it was shot on digital cameras,
Sort of like cheaper digital cameras, in some cases consumer grade digital cameras. And a lot of the dialogue was improvised.
Yeah.
Scenes were written, but a lot of the dialogue was encouraged to be padded out by the actors. And so scenes would sort of find their way through, and the topics of a lot of these movies tended to be relationships and family and the sorts of things that are cliched trappings of independent cinema.
Or sort of coming of age, regardless of what year you're in, like you're in your 20s or your 30s. And you'll get a lot of films from like Joe Swanberg is a good example.
I was going to say, and at some point, a Duplass is going to be involved somehow.
I look at the mumblecore movement as, in many respects, maybe not as artistically significant, but in many respects, it's kind of the 21st century American version of Italian neorealism, where here's a bunch of young filmmakers who are not interested in making genre entertainments. They're trying to tell stories that seem realistic to them, plausible, using cinematic techniques that are all about sort of just intimate human drama, not calling attention to themselves, not flashy. In an effort to tell stories that are not being told by major studios.
Yeah.
And I would argue that there are much better films in the Italian neorealist movement than we got in the mumblecore movement. But I still think that the attitude is there, where we're trying to do our own thing. It has nothing to do with that we're expected to have.
You're comparing it to Italian neorealism. I would say it's a much more direct descendant of the independent cinema of, like, Cassavetes in the 70s.
Okay.
Where those sorts of films were about sort of intimate drama issues, and they were filmed in this very kind of naturalistic style with this very kind of naturalistic acting.
Mm-hmm.
Cassavetes told stories mostly about, like, marriages. If you haven't seen it, watch A Woman Under the Influence. That's my favorite of his. Mm-hmm. But they're all pretty damn good. And I feel like when Joe Swanberg, the Duplass, there's Lynn Shelton, Bujalski was the name I couldn't come up. Bujalski is one of the sort of like the forerunners. Andrew Bujalski did a lot of the mumblecore movies. I feel like they are taking a lot of their cues from American independent traditions of a little bit more recently than Italian neorealism.
Yeah.
But yeah, their films are very talky. They tend to be about aimlessness a lot, about sort of people who are trying to find their lives.
Mm-hmm.
When people say mumblecore, they're not just referring to the style. And it's really curious that, you know, mumblegore has become a thing.
Yeah.
Because this is the same sort of style, but in a horror tradition.
Yeah, can we do a horror story using these incredibly lo-fi cinematic techniques and these very character-driven narratives. Some have argued that Your Next is mumblegore. It's not. I don't think so.
No,
I think it's way too polished for that. It just happens to have some people who are famous in the mumblecore movement involved.
The House of the Devil, I think, is maybe a little too slick, but it's also definitely taking a lot of its cues from mumblecore.
Yeah. I think if there's actually any actual like really good. Oh wait, I got a list here of alleged mumblegore movies.
You can look it up on Wikipedia.
Oh, here's a good one. I think this is actually, I would argue that this is a mumblegore. Ty West's The Innkeepers.
He also did House of the Devil.
Yeah, but I would argue The Innkeepers is more mumblegore than anything because it's
a lot
about
more conversation. Yeah.
The Innkeepers is a pretty good movie actually.
The Innkeepers a lot.
It's about two people who work at a historic inn or hotel that is allegedly quite haunted, and they just shoot the shit about whether or not this place is haunted, and then it might be haunted. It's pretty good.
Mm.
It's pretty solid. Let's see, the VHS movies, people have argued that those are mumblegore.
That's more of a found footage thing.
I agree. Kill List is an interesting attempt to make that play. Kill List might work.
Kill List, I think it is, because a lot of that film is focusing, it's about these two assassins. But most of the movie is them when they're not on a job. They're just sort of hanging around a lot.
And then it turns out
relationship troubles.
And it turns out their series of jobs may all be connected to some kind of weird evil thing.
So it's like,
I don't want to ruin it for you. I think ultimately it boils down to very little. But a lot of people really like that movie a lot.
I don't. I don't like Kill List. Yeah. I feel like
I see what they're getting at. I don't think it works.
A good idea, but I think it was just poorly executed. Mumblegore, I think, is a little bit more debatable, but just because horror is such a fluid genre.
Mm-hmm. And it often can be a bit of an artificial genre as well, just by its nature.
Oh, you know what? You know what is a mumblegore film is Frozen, not the Disney film.
The Adam Green? Is it Adam Green who did that?
I'd have to look it up.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, there was a movie called Frozen.
Adam Green. Yeah.
Adam Green, about a couple that was stuck on a ski lift.
Like, and overnight.
They're
like trapped.
They went on a ski lift, it stopped, and it was getting colder, and the night was falling. And it was one of those like single location, claustrophobic location horror movies. And yeah, it was how do they get off a ski lift? And I like movies like that because that gets your mind thinking, what would I do in that situation?
Oh, you know what's another one that I would argue, I don't think it's usually considered mumble gore, but I would give it the imprimatur.
Mm.
Open Water.
It was a similar thing. Yeah,
Open Water is a very similar premise where about two people who go scuba diving, and then the people who are in charge of like the scuba diving vacation, they miscount the number of the people on the boat, so then they just sail off, and when these two people finally come up for air, there's no boat.
Yeah,
they're just adrift in the ocean, and no one finds out for days, and by that point it's too late for them.
Mm.
And it's just them in the water. Basically, their marriage is dissolving in front of our eyes, and also they're going to die.
Yeah.
it's a very depressing film.
So that's mumblecore.
Yeah.
It has its fans, it has its defenders, it has its detractors.
Do you have a favorite mumblecore film?
I'm very fond of Beeswax.
I haven't seen that one.
It's about a young woman who's a photographer and her relationship with her sister.
Okay.
One of the very few positive examples of a disabled protagonist.
Mm.
The protagonist is in a wheelchair, and it's presented in a very sort of frank, natural fashion. I really like that one.
Okay.
And I think that's Bujalski Beeswax.
That's fine. I think my favorite is probably a film called Drinking Buddies. It's a Joe Swanberg film. Stars Olivia Wilde, Jake Johnson.
Beeswax is Andy Bujalski.
And it's just about two people who, they work at like a brewery together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're clearly into each other, but they've never been single at the same time. So they've never done anything. They never like capitalized on all this like sort of sexual tension they've always had. And there's a very brief window where they might be single at the same time. And it's just them debating whether or not to do something about it. And it's relatable.
Have you ever had a friendship like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
I think we all have. It's like, we're attracted to each other, but
the timing was never right.
We are dating other people right now, so we can just sort of say that and then move on.
Yeah, it's if you've ever been in a situation like that, I think at least some of Drinking Buddies will resonate with you. It's a good film. Anyway, that's it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you everybody for writing in. Great questions this week. If you want to write in through a future episode, you can totally do so. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. Box, those who like to send physical letters or anything else in the mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yay!
Write us a letter.
We'd love to hear from you.
On paper.
Yeah, it's fun.
Or on a deer skin, I don't care.
No, don't. Poor deer, don't do that.
Found deer skin, don't actually kill the deer.
Okay, just find it in like an alleyway or something. And just,
It died in the alleyway.
Natural causes. It got dark real quick.
Absolutely.
But we're also on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibel.
We have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We do hangouts every month. If you want to talk to us in person, that's the best way to do it. We also have a lot of exclusive shows, including shows about Star Trek, Batman, the Academy Awards. That's running a little late. We got to get on that this week.
Yeah, indeed.
But a lot of stuff there as well. So thank you to every single one of our patrons, without whom this show and all of our other shows would not be possible. It means a lot to us.
Yes.
And I'm forgetting anything. Oh, and you have a show as well called All About Ovid.
That's right. I do. Yeah. It's slipped my mind, and I apologize greatly to my co-host, B. Peterson. We have a podcast together called All About Ovid. We talk about Ovid, the streaming service Ovid, which is one of the best streaming services. They have a lot of deep cut art house stuff and a lot of international cinema from recent years. And on this last episode, we talked about An Elephant Sitting Still, the film by Hubo from 2018, which is one of the best films of the decade. It is just this amazing contemplation of sadness and despair. We compared it to the Book of Job. And we also watched other short films that Hubo was involved in besides, because Nothing Sitting Still was Hubo's only movie. It was his first feature film. It was also his last, because he committed suicide shortly after making it. There's a lot to talk about in that movie, and B has made it their goal to watch this film every year, make it sort of an annual tradition, and this is a tradition I encourage. So yeah, go over and listen to the 20th episode of All About Ovid to hear us talk about Hoopo and An Elephant Sitting Still, which is available on Ovid. And then watch that movie, because it's really, really good.
Cool. So there's that. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, again. You're super awesome. Mm-hmm. Love you all. And we'll see you next week on another episode of We've Got Mail. And there will be other podcasts as well, because this is what we do. Anyway, bye. Sincerely yours, Pibbs and Whitney.